Speaker Christine.
My name's Christine. I'm Attic. My clean date is April 15, 2000, and today I have 5 years clean. You know, I just got told about 15 minutes ago that I needed to speak, and I was like, okay, wait a minute. I have to pee, and I have to eat lunch because I'm hungry. And no, but, you know, I guess it's my higher power's will for me to do this. Wow. I guess I'll start at the beginning. When I got here, I wasn't like any of you guys because y'all were too old. Y'all were old enough to be my parents. I'm 25 years old. When I got here, I was 20. And I thank God for that today because I hit my bottom real early. And a lot of older recovering addicts tell me that I'm truly blessed to hit it at such an early age. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. My father died when I was 5 years old. I watched him die of testicular cancer, and that was the first time that I knew that I didn't have control because I couldn't save him. After that, my mom got real sick, and I began to take care of her. I had caretaking issues early on. She developed an ulcer, and she was sick so much to the point that we would sleep in the bathroom together because that's how much she was sick. So anyway, we moved around a lot. We moved in with my grandmother on her side, and she was my life. She was my heart. You know, when people at school would talk about me and, you know, do things to me, she was the one who always listened to me and always told me that I would grow up to be a really beautiful young woman. And I was like, yeah, right, Mima, I don't think so, you know, that's not true. And, you know, she always, like, made sure, like, reaffirmed that I was going to be somebody someday. And I knew early on that I was different from everybody else in my school and just around me. I thought differently. I acted differently. I always thought that I could get away with something. I was a tomboy. I played sports. And I had boobs before anybody else in my class did. So, you know, they talked about me then. But now today, that's a blessing. That's amazing how things work out. But anyway, you know, I played sports, and that was my outlet. That was my way out. And, you know, my brother, he was in a heavy metal band, and he used to practice, him and his friends, in the basement. And, you know, they'd have their Friday, Saturday night jam sessions and stuff, and he's my older brother. I wanted to be just like him. I even shaved the sides and the back of my head just like him, you know, started smoking cigarettes just like him because I didn't have that father figure there. He was the closest thing that I had, and, you know, it seemed like the more I tried to cling on to him, the further he pushed me away and wanted to be with his girlfriend and wanted to be with his friends. So, you know, I can remember I was always like the little sister that was, you know, tugging at his pants legs, please let me come downstairs, you know. And one night I got my wish, and they let me come downstairs, and there was always this weird smell coming from the basement, and I could never figure out what it was. I just thought it was like a different brand of cigarettes that they smoked or something. Yeah, it was a different brand of cigarettes, all right. And, you know, I learned about drugs and stuff like that in school, and, you know, used to watch all them talk shows about kids getting involved with drugs and, you know, becoming prostitutes, and thought, wow, I'm never going to do that. You know, that's not going to be my life. I'm going to be somebody someday. I'm not going to be somebody standing on the corner. Little did I know. So anyway, they let me down in the basement, and, you know, they were jamming out and stuff. I was rocking along, and then practice, the jam session was over, and I went into my brother's room, and I was just about to go back upstairs, and one of his friends was like, nah, come on in here, man, we're about to party. And, you know, I'm like 12, 13 years old, and these older people are like inviting me in to what they do, and for once, I felt a part of. And I wanted to keep that feeling going. So went in there, and they were passing around this soda can, right, that was crushed in the middle.
Yeah.
And,
Tell your story.
I am. I'm going to tell my story. And, It had this funny-looking green stuff in the middle of it, right? And they were like, here, try this. And I was like, it seemed like my whole life just flashed before my eyes. You know, all those things you hear in school, at how people try drugs for the first time, they die. And all those, like, crazy thoughts ran through my head. But what I do, I put it to my mouth anyway. Despite those thoughts and despite that feeling that said, no, this is not right. I ignored that. I learned how to push that good part of my brain back and dilute it. So it took about a few minutes before it started working. And I just started laughing. I don't know what was going on with me. Just this feeling came over me, and I loved it, and I wanted to keep it going. And, of course, had to go back upstairs, and I seen all the food in the kitchen. And I was like, oh, boy, especially Doritos. Even today, I still have a hard time with Doritos. And got the munchies real bad, and then it was time to go to sleep. And I was like, wow. That, you know, kind of sucked, wore off pretty quick. But, you know, they continued to let me go in the basement with them. And my grandmother had died from Alzheimer's. And, I began taking care of her, too. I was the only one that would go in there and give her medicine. I was the only one that would go in there and feed her, you know. My mom was deep in her addiction at the time, you know, popping pills and falling asleep in her food. And, you know, I'm picking her up and sitting her back in her chair and covering her up with a blanket. You know, so my caretaking issues have not stopped, even still to this day. I want to fix you, but I can't fix me. You know, my brother, he, like, pushed himself away from my grandmother because he didn't want to deal with the fact that she was sick and that she was losing her mind and didn't know who you were sometimes when you'd go in the room and be like, who are you? You know, I'd be like, it's me. You know, me and Mom, what are you talking about? And once again, when the shit hit the fan, I was the only one left there standing. And I hate that feeling. And today, it still bothers me to talk about it. And so she passed away, and my aunt had a power of attorney over my grandmother's house. And within a matter of 15 minutes at the age of 14, I lost everything that I had known in that household. We were told we had to leave and that we could not come back. And so all of a sudden I was homeless, and my mom was being taken away to the insane asylum. And me and my sister are standing there on the porch. Brother's already gone. Me and my sister are just standing there on the porch looking at each other like, what did we do to get here? You know, I didn't do anything. So we went to a foster home for a few days until my mom got out, and I guess she proved the doctors wrong that she wasn't crazy. But I find differently today. but that's my opinion. I don't have a medical degree. So anyway, you know, that whole summer, it was the summer of 1994, and I spent that whole summer being homeless with my mom and my sister, sleeping in the back of a 1985 two-door Celica with all of our stuff and two other people. And, you know, we went to social services and sat in there and, you know, for God knows how many hours until we could get a place. And we got a place in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And, you know, for the first time when I moved there, guys were paying attention to me. We were pretty much the only white family in the neighborhood. So they really paid attention to me. And I loved that. I loved that feeling. I would go to school, and I would go in the front door and leave out the back. And I'm telling you all this to tell you about the behavior early on. And when you look back at your story, you will see your behavior develop long before you ever started using or using heavily. You know, I wouldn't go to school, and at the age of 16, you know, I dropped out and was like, you know, screw it, I'll just get my GED and get a job, and who knows what else I'll do. I don't know. And, you know, we moved around a lot, and that was because my mom was not really responsible. She couldn't hold a job. She couldn't get to work on time, couldn't pay the rent. And I vowed that, you know, when I became old enough to control those things, that I would make sure I do those things, pay my rent on time, and go to work and be there on time most days. It's amazing, you know, when you tell your story out loud, it's really powerful, especially for me today. So, you know, we moved around a lot, and when I was 16 and 17, I hooked up with this girl, right? She was like 10 years older than me, and she was one of those people that smoked crack off and on, right? That's all I knew, that she was one of those people that smoked crack off and on, and, you know, she was my blunt smoking buddy, you know, and when she was with me, she didn't smoke crack, so she was okay. You know, I had a big thing against crackheads. You know, they were dirty, they're nasty, they stole, blah, blah, blah. Little did I know I'd be one of those one day. So we started hanging out, and, you know, just like I have a sponsor in here, I had a sponsor out there. And, you know, she showed me what to do. She's probably one of the best teachers, but that's toxic for me to say that. So we were hanging out, and, you know, I was like 2-3 weeks away from going to Job Corps and trying to do something right. And I hadn't used in like, I don't know, like 3 weeks. And you have to have your urine clean for like a month, right? And my mom didn't like the fact that I had just came from one friend's house and wanted to go to her house. And, you know, she was like, if you leave, you take all your stuff with you. I'm like, all right, peace. I grabbed all my stuff and, you know, I moved in with this girl. And, you know, she had, you know, crack dealers coming in and out of her house all the time. I loved the excitement. I loved the you know, just everything that went with that lifestyle. I loved it. It excited me. And that's not what I grew up in. I grew up in the suburbs in Montgomery County. That's not me. You know, but all of a sudden I had been transformed to this dingy, disgusting apartment. And that wasn't my bottom. And my bottom was a lot worse. So, you know, we got kicked out of there. Windows got kicked in. Police came. It was terrible. You know, and I didn't have any money. I didn't have any food. I didn't have anything. I didn't have a job. And so what was there left for me to do? Well, she had told me what she had done to get money because she always had money, but I didn't know where she got it from because she didn't have a job. And she was like, well, this is what I do. And y'all know what I'm talking about. But see, I didn't think that I was a prostitute because I used a pager, right? If you needed me, you paged me. So I was in denial about that for a long time. And I didn't stand on the corner either. You know, I walked back and forth, you know, but I didn't stand on no corner. And you know, I never want to forget that first feeling, how it felt the first time I had to do that. And he handed me the money afterwards. And that low-down, disgusting, all-gone feeling. I never want to forget that. But, you know, what I do, I kept doing it. And, you know, after a while, you become kind of good at it. And you use drugs to suppress your feelings and use more drugs and do more things. And it's just a vicious cycle. You just keep going until you die. And, you know, I had this little scheme where I would steal from one Nordstrom's and take the merchandise back to the other one and return it. Like, I had bought it. You know, me shopping at Nordstrom's, you know, I'd get like 4 or 5 necklaces. It was like $500. I was on. You know, we get a hotel room, get some Alizé and some whatever else, get some weed, and I was on. And I had this little scheme. I was doing it for a while, and got busted one day walking out the door of Montgomery Mall. Mm-mm-mm. And they stopped me, and the first thing I said, I didn't do it. They were like, we know you did. We've seen you. We've been following you. Just come with us. So, you know, I went to Montgomery County Detention Center and got out 3-4 hours later and was, you know, all excited, like, I have been in jail, yeah, you know, and finally, you know, one in the crowd, like, just, I don't know what I was thinking. And so I had to go to court eventually. And then like 3-4 days later, I used to work at a gas station at night. I robbed my job. I took money out the drawer and like actually called the police and said that somebody had just robbed me, even swelled up some tears real good. And I was like, please come help me. They just robbed me. Even gave them a description of somebody that didn't even exist. And the money was in my pocket. And so those two events happened, you know, like within 3 days of each other. And Thanksgiving of 1997, I spent it in Montgomery County Detention Center as a result of that charge and the other charge. And so now I had to go to... I had to see, you know, a probation officer on a regular basis. I had to allow them to come and visit my home and see where I lived. And at this point, we had transferred to Langley Park. And I still have a hard time with that today. But I thank God for that, because if it hadn't have been for me moving there, I would have never hit my bottom, one of my many bottoms. So... we left in one part of Langley Park, moved to the other part of Langley Park, and I'm still with the same girl now, okay? And it was July of 1998, my mom's birthday. And I was real upset about some things, and she had some crack, and she was like, you want to try some? I was like, okay. So I did it. And, you know, when I started smoking crack, I was 220 pounds. By the time I finished, 11 months later, I was 130. And, you know, thought I had it going on. I really did. Just letting things happen all over the place. It got busted in March of 1999 by the undercovers on 495. Right before you get to the Montgomery County, PG County border. And I thank God that we did not cross that border. Otherwise, my ass would have been going to Upper Marlboro. And, whew, that's not a pretty place, I hear. I don't want to find out. And, you know, I had to go to court, and I didn't. And then the bounty hunters were looking for me. And that really excited me. You know, so I'm a white girl in Langley Park with long blonde hair to my ass trying to hide from the police. Let me tell you, that did not work very well. Okay? Going outside with hoodies on, you know, walking like this, thinking that nobody was going to know who I am. And what I'm telling you is I'm telling you about the insanity that I continue to practice over and over and over again, and even sometimes still today, knowing that it's not working, but yet still I continue to do it anyway. So got busted, you know, by the bounty hunters, and... They found me coming out the elevator of where my mom was staying at, and, you know, what could I do? The elevator doors opened, and three of them were standing right there. Immediately, I knew where I was going. I started taking off my jewelry. I was like, all right, you know, come on, let's go. And they turned, you know, they let me turn myself in, so they lost out on the bail money. And they were so cool to me. They actually could see that I had a problem. For the first time, somebody could see that there was something much more deeper there than just the things that I were doing. There was something wrong. And so this time I went to court. I got my stuff together. You know, I got a little job as a lifeguard at the neighborhood pool and still continued to smoke weed. I hadn't smoked crack. I thought weed was okay because it grew from the ground and, you know, it was natural, and I didn't have a problem with that. Crack was my problem, not weed. And I'm here to tell you that everything was my problem. My drug of choice is more. If it makes me feel good, I want more. So, you know, I went to court and they ordered me to go to outpatient treatment and take urinalysis 2 times a week. And... you know, so I was like, all right, cool, you know, I can still do this. And I even went as far as to get a gold card membership to GNC to buy the tea, you know, so I could keep smoking weed and take the urinalysis and be clean. You know, I would drink a gallon of tea on the bus on the way to the Hyattsville courthouse to take my urine. And the tea didn't hit me till I was on the way home and had to pee like shit on the bus. Oh, I would smoke on the way to the urine and pray to God that it wouldn't be dirty. I gave up 22 dirty urines to parole and probation, and normally after 3, they lock you up. But by the grace of God, my case, like, I guess, fell to the bottom of somebody's desk. And, you know, my PO called me, and he was like, you know, I'm going to give you 30 days to clean up your urine. Otherwise, I'm going to have to violate you, and then you might go to jail for 18 months. He was like, and I don't want you to go to jail. I was like, okay. So, you know, I was still doing this outpatient thing, and, you know, they were telling me that I had to go to these meetings, and I was like, yeah, okay. And for like 2 whole months that I was in outpatient, you know, I didn't go to meetings, and I would just go to that. I thought that was my meeting. Little did I know. So I remember the first time I found an NA meeting, and I walked in there, and you know, people were clapping and smiling and laughing, and I was like, look at all these old people in here, man. I do not belong here. What are they doing to me? You know, I just kept punching holes in everything because I was different. And then, you know, I started listening. And even though I still continued to use, I still kept coming back. And I kept listening. Something was planted in me. Not to mention that I had to get my slip signed. So that's another reason why I had to keep coming back in the beginning. So, you know, that was November of 99. I didn't get clean until April of 2000. And, you know, I was picking up key tags for clean time that I didn't have, had a sponsor, tried to work the first step, still using. That was a trip. Even wrote it out and everything. I'm here to tell you, I ripped that part of my notebook up today and threw it in the trash because it was all bullshit, and started over. So anyway, you know, I hit my bottom. I was at the gas station, and I knew that. See, once I was exposed to this message, I could not use again successfully. Every time I got high, I felt guilty. And then I would get high some more, and then I would sit there with the blunt in my hand and try to read Just for Today, thinking that I was changing my life. But see, I'm glad that I did that, because the seed kept, it was, just seeds were being planted all over the place, and it started to grow. And one night, I was at the gas station. I had nobody to smoke with. It was me and my 2 blunts, and that was it. And I stayed up all night, of course, because I was working. And, you know, I went to a meeting like 2 days later. I told my sponsor and I told the home group that I belonged to, that I've been using the whole time I've been there. And they said, it's okay, we love you, just keep coming back. And, you know, that was 5 years ago today. And, you know, this topic, letting the newcomer live. People let me live when I got here. The women, like, surrounded me. And that's not who I wanted in my life. I wanted all the guys to be around me. And, you know, I would come in meetings and I would share about this guy did this to me this day and blah, blah, blah. Because I did stuff in here clean that I wouldn't even done out there using. You know, you take the drugs away, but the behavior is still there. And I thought that the drugs were my only problem. Now that I've stopped using, everything's supposed to be okay. Everything's supposed to be hunky-dory. No, I don't think so. So, you know, I used to always say to my sponsor, how come no guys ever come up to me and ask me out? She was like, Christine, they hear you share. They know better. They trying to work on something today. And they let me live. They let me go through my process, you know. I'm here to tell you that I'm married today. I just got married like 6 months ago. To a guy who has been there for me ever since one of those many bottoms that I have hit. Every time I was tired, angry, lonely, just had enough, he would always come and get me. And he never turned his back on me. One time he did, but that was for his own sanity. You know, and he's recovering too, you know, one day at a time. So anyway, you know, I would come to meetings and try to talk to my sponsor, and I kept hearing this stuff about doing step work. And I was like, oh, I ain't doing no work. I did enough to get here. Why I gotta do work now? Can't I just be clean and go to meetings and fellowship and go to dances and play softball and do all those lovely things and hang out and eat dinner till we can't eat anymore? And she was like, no. You have to do some step work. So it took me 4 years to write my first step. That's my process. It doesn't have to be yours, and I always say that. I've heard worse than that, though. But they say the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using, and I truly have a desire not to use today. The obsession has been lifted. So anyway, you know, now I'm in the middle of my second step and writing it out and just trying to allow a higher power to come into my life more so than it ever has before. This program has been a blessing. There's people in my life today that I would have never picked to be in my life. All them old people that, you know, claimed they were my friends, you know, we'll ride till we die and get high and all that shit, they're gone. God has removed them from my life and replaced them with people that actually care about me and love me and want to be around me. People actually want to be around me. Can you imagine that? I still get blown away when I think about that. You know, and I love this program. I love everything it has to offer. I still consider myself a newcomer. And, you know, I love the way this fellowship just wraps you up when you get here and tells you it's okay. No matter what you do, just keep coming back. That's the message that I've heard today. That's the message that I always hear. It's okay. If you screw up, it's okay. You know, give yourself a break. And, you know, I want to thank the committee for asking me to come and share at the last minute. Thanks a lot. I'm really hungry. And so anyway. this has really been, it's really been a journey for me to get here. And now that I look back on it, it's been a blessing. And I see now a little bit of what my higher power's will for me is. And with that, I'll keep coming back. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing, Christine. This time I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Walston.
Thank you. Thank you, Christine. My name is Walston. I'm an addict. And it's real good to be here. Real good to be here. Got a lot to say, and I know that it's not my doing what I say, and so I need to let the Creator in, kind of settle my spirit. A lot of friends in the audience, and I appreciate all the love that people show me in this program. And I think that's what we're talking about, really, when we talk about letting a newcomer live. You know, Christine mentioned that she considered herself a newcomer. Well, I just celebrated on Tuesday my 55th birthday. And she said she was 25, and I mean, I'm not real good at math, but yeah, I'm 30 years older than her, you know. And then she said she's 5 years clean, and I was thinking, well, God has graced me with 13 years, and I still consider myself a newcomer. So when they offered me the topic, and I need to also say thanks to the East of the River for asking me to participate in this workshop. Downstairs, they asked me about what area was I from, and my home group is It Works How and Why. It meets Monday nights at 7 o'clock, and that's in Central Maryland area. But I also attend a group that I consider my home group, which is Men's Wrap at Trust Clinic, D.C. area. So often I've come to this convention, and on this little badge, I'd put all metropolitan. You know, I hate being put in a box. But, you know, I found that this program has helped me kind of get right-sized, if you will, because there was nothing right-sized about me before I got to this program. So, you know, I kind of asked myself the question, why in the hell did they ask me to talk about letting a newcomer live? And I went to some of my friends, my colleagues, and asked them what they thought about it. And, of course, for me, the first thought that came to my mind was the whole relationship, the predatory kind of relationship that men and women sometimes bring to the program. And after getting out of my way and kind of meditating and praying on this thing a little bit, some things started to be revealed to me that hopefully I can in some way convey in my sharing today. But I think it's also important for those that don't know me to know that I'm truly, truly here by the grace, that I did everything to kill myself. I did not like me, period. I mean, how many of y'all ever heard of a dope fiend named Walston? Come on, man. See, she laughing now. And then, you know, when you play a clarinet in the school marching band, you know, and I always say it didn't matter that I was the first clarinetist, which meant I was the best. What mattered most was how I thought you saw me. And it wasn't the perception I wanted you to have of me. So I struggled with self from the very beginning. And substances, early on, I think you mentioned 12 or something like that. I was probably 13 or 14 when I started snorting dope. And the dope at that time sold for a dollar. I mean, you could get it for a dollar. And it became my best friend. It became the panacea. It became the elixir for all the insecurities, all of the inadequacies. And I vowed I had to have it at all costs. At all costs. And I sought out to do that. And the interesting thing about that is God was continuing to bless me in spite of me being in my way. And I'm clear today that the disease of addiction really centers in my thinking. And I didn't recognize that when I finally started searching for my bottom, because I didn't realize I was on a journey to get to a bottom. You know, I just thought I was having fun. You know, that I was one of those guys that, you know, see how much you can do. You know, a mind over matter kind of guy. All that old crazy, insane stuff that I tell myself to justify continuing to kill myself. And that lasted from, like I said, 13 or 14 till 41. 41 when the Creator sent my angels in blue with handcuffs. Rescued me from me and put me in what I hope was the last institution, because I had been in many during those 25, 30 years of using detoxes, hospitals, being shot. It's important that I share that stuff because I need to remember my story. I need to remember what I do to me with no help. And the thing about this program is it's so powerful when I'm given the opportunity to tell my story, whether anybody gets anything or not. And Christine said it, I benefit. When I'm put in a position to try to carry a message and stand at a podium and share about injecting drugs in, that's not FDA approved. You know where you put money in a slot and you don't even see who give you the package back? And you go cook that, put some water on it, rain water perhaps, some works that somebody else has given you that they didn't use, or that might have come out of a bag in an oil joint, and you inject that in your hand or your neck, and you do that repeatedly, and then you get an opportunity to stand at a podium and say, yeah, that's what I did to me for a lot of years. It's something real humbling about that. So, I'm truly grateful. I used until I humiliated myself, my family, and anybody that came in my path. I used liquid, solid, gas, human, it don't matter. I used you. And I found out as a result of those angels coming in blue that they were in fact my angels. And they put me in what I said was, I hope, the last institution. And I was reintroduced to Narcotics Anonymous. I had been introduced to the program probably 8 years prior to that arrest. And when I got introduced that previous 8 years, I stayed in a detox for 3 days, and somebody told me I had a check at home. Y'all know the rest of the story. All right, open the door. I got to go. Yeah. I left, and it was 8 years of madness, pure madness. And I found moments of happiness, you know, in the hype. The pipe, I don't like crack, but give me the flip. I use anything that'll change my mood. And I'm clear about that today. So the topic is very appropriate for me, I believe, because I've done a little work on me. And hopefully I can impart something that somebody might need to hear, because I value Narcotics Anonymous. I value the process that God has dropped me in. All of the using I did was because I was not all right with me. Consequently, I was not all right with you. And so the paradox that I see in all of this, and paradoxes to me are very important in my life, my journey, in that I find that trying to escape me, trying to escape y'all, he brought me right back to y'all. So now I come back to y'all, and it's real easy for me to sit in a meeting or a room and start to compare out. Wow. It's real easy for me to say, why are they chasing that newcomer sister? You know what I mean? You've been around here for a while, you see? And then I had to, as I say, continue to explore what I'll do, because it's always about me. You know, I need to stop pointing the finger and take a look at, well, wait, what's your story in this whole grand scheme of things? How do you fit in this? And I started looking at all the guys that have come to me and females and said, Walston, will you help me with this process of the steps? You know, and how I've had opportunities where guys have come across my, you know, when we start getting clean, we start getting some stuff. You know, I've had guys come to me and say, man, every time I get my paycheck, I relapse. And I've heard other sponsors say, well, you need to let me know when you're going to get your check. I'm an addict. Yeah, I like things. Stuff. And it's real easy for this conniving, manipulative dope fiend under the guise of helping someone. Oh, y'all, I know anybody did that in here. You see, or the sponsor, you say, look, I'm running into some money. I got an inheritance, and I really need you. You know, we can just cut through the chase. I don't have to manipulate. I really need you, sponsor, to hold this for me. And if you need to use some of it, it's cool. Yeah, huh? You know, and what I found is that even though there have been situations where, in fact, I've been put in that position and have had to put money back, the fact of the matter is, it's happened to me. And when I get the opportunity to stand at the podium and reveal that, there's some freedom in that. Because I ain't doing that today. I'm talking about what I've done. I'm talking about what I still do if I don't let the program continue to work for me, which is finding some truth in my existence. My whole being caught up in the disease of addiction is about living a lie. You find out your way to freedom is telling the truth, and you're going to still hide under the guise of you are spiritually have spiritually arrived. My grand sponsor used to say when you are, because I remember my sponsor talking about having multiple affairs, and he would say, well, Walston, you know, what he's doing is he's pissing in the water he's got to wash his face with. I said, what you say? Oh, but ain't nobody in here never been in the pool and had to pee, right? Or you got out the pool and went to the bathroom. Oh, I might be crass, but I'm talking about the reality of how I live my life and how I can parallel, you know, what I do, you know, literally and figuratively. It's real important for me to recognize that when I start looking at personalities, What I first better do is look at myself. Because I'm real easy at judging folk. The literature talks real clearly about, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire. And if I show the desire and I show up in a room like this and forget that this room, this group, is a microcosm of society at large, I forget where I'm at. Because what y'all helping me do is learn how to live out there. But I come in here and think y'all supposed to be just right, honest, and all that old good shit, and I'm thinking myself out into finding a way out of here. That's why I need not place personalities before principles. But I won't know what else to do if I don't get somebody to help guide me in understanding what the principles are. Y'all, some of y'all missing this shit, because I'm talking about the fact that I can't come in a room and start putting people on pedestals. Because when I do that, I set myself up for just what I get, whether I be male or female. Let me just go to the fifth tradition, because see, that might help me a little bit more, bring home the point. It says, you mean to say that our primary purpose is to carry the message? I thought we were here to get clean. Well, goddammit, that's what I came in here for. But what I found out was my problem was much deeper than drugs. That the drugs was just a symptom of my problem. And see, my real problem was my inability to have healthy relationships. So I get in relationships because I don't feel all right about me, and I expect you to make me feel good about me. But what I need to learn how to do is bring the same thing I expect to the relationship that I want from you to bring to the relationship. But I fall short. You see, so it's important that I'm recognizing what the hell this thing is about. Healthy relationships. I don't know how to have them. It goes on to say, I thought that our primary purpose was to recover from drug addiction for the individual. This is certainly true, for the individual. Our members are here to find freedom from addiction and a new way of life. That's the key, and a new way of life. However, groups aren't addicted and don't recover. Now, I've been around some groups that I thought was mighty goddamn toxic. All our groups can do is plant the seed for recovery and bring addicts together so that the magic of empathy, honesty, caring, sharing, and service can do their work. Later in this tradition, it says the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. And I just talked about how under the guise of the therapeutic value, I can find myself in a position where the disease will win. For the newcomers, this is how they found Narcotics Anonymous and learned to stay clean. For the members, this reaffirms their commitment to recovery. The group is the most powerful vehicle we have for carrying the message. When a member carries the message, check this out. He is somewhat bound by interpretation and personality. So you get what I interpret. You get what personality you see. The problem with literature is the language. The feelings, the intensity, and the strength are sometimes lost. In our group, with many different personalities, the message of recovery is a recurring theme. What I get out of that is pretty much how important diversity is. I'm very pleased that I had the opportunity to share this podium with one that's 30 years younger, female, and white. I think that's the way my creator works. The sponsor I drove up here with, white guy, I'd have never picked him. I ain't in charge. Letting a newcomer live is important stuff to me. You know, I think that one of the things that has also brought me to a place to be able to share on this topic is that I've, in fact, as decrepit, as scandalous as I was in my addiction, because all I ever did on top of using drugs was use women. I use women, all women. I use women because I don't know how to do anything other than that. And I come to a program where I started to talk about empathy and caring and honesty and all that good stuff. And you know what I did? I started to work on me because I didn't want to be the same me. I didn't want to die the way I was about to die. So I sat in the meetings and I raised my hand. There wasn't no raising my hand on 14th Street. We ain't raise our hand on 14th Street to talk. You dig? So I came in the rooms, I started raising my hand to share. And I was not waltzing on the street, believe that. And I told my name. I started telling truths. I started trying to treat people the way I wanted to be treated. And I'm not trying to put myself somewhere. I'm telling you my story. That I've been here for 13 years, and I haven't been out of my relationship in 13 years. And to me, that's just as important as me not shooting no dope in 13 years. That's the disease of addiction, being arrested. And so when we talk about letting the newcomers live, I've managed to do that because it's just as easy as I can say that, I can say, I see y'all out there. Oh, yeah, when y'all walk through the door in the meetings, oh, yeah, Snubby ain't all the way dead. Some of y'all might have heard me talk about me when I think, when I say, I got a party, but I got to be quiet. This party is about getting free. See, if you come in the program and keep trying to hide out, then you're losing your blessing. I don't have no secrets up in here. You know, I talk about me easily. And I'm talking about, you know, understanding that getting involved with a wife for 13 years and then starting to grow older and starting to wonder why the equipment don't work like it used to work. Oh, I know what I need to do. Because she smiled at you in the meeting yesterday. You know, the new girl that wants you to help her with the steps. Oh, I had a young lady that's in this room right now ask me, and I helped her. And you know what happened when we got to four? I said, let me put you with this sister over here. Yeah. That's what the program helped me do. And why not? Because I'm all of that. It's because I'm practicing the program. The feelings ain't gone, but I practice the program. See, I try not to let me run me no more. I try not to listen to that boombox in my head. I try to practice. They tell me that the road to recovery is always under construction. So I'm a work in progress is what I'm talking about. I'm not a finished product by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. I'm having more fun than I ever had in life. They say if you ain't doing this right, it's just like sex. You ain't doing it right. So I come in here. I try to find a place. I get in where I fit in. I try to posture in some humility because I think that's one of our major problems as a result of suffering from such low self-esteem. I think that's a common denominator. I want to feel better about me. And narcotics kind of did that for a long time. Then you done took my dope away and the low self-esteem resurfaced. You see, because I already became a walking egomaniac out there while I was on it. Because you couldn't, on the corner, it wasn't about going up to somebody telling them, I need to share. I'm feeling a bit inadequate, Mike. You know, you better get you some money. You know. So I come in here and these feelings of inadequacy resurface. And the ego is still there. The defects of character are still there. So it's important for me to work on me. So I try real hard to posture in some humility because I just don't know. And it's all right to say I don't know. But I know that this program works. I know that. You know, they was talking about, my grand sponsor also mentioned to me about how, in fact, when we kind of, you know, go our ways and do our things. Excuse the terminology, but I have to tell it the way he told me. He said, it's almost like getting fucked with a barbed wire dick. I said, you got a real... that would hurt. I said, Tom, you got a real graphic way of driving home points, you know? I think it's real important to... not take this thing so serious that I can't have fun. You know, but I do think it's important to recognize that this is serious business. And when we see the newcomer come in and don't give them an opportunity to find their place, to grow up in here, to not judge them when they ramble, you know, not give them a ride home and take the money that they might offer for gas. Never refuse the money. I only got $2, but it's $2. Man, put your $2 up, man. Get somebody else a ride one day. You know, I've had the opportunity to do that, and I found that in doing that, the blessings I've gotten back far exceed anything I could have got at that moment. There's a Sanskrit proverb that my sponsor gave me that goes, in destiny, we're all brothers and sisters. None goes his or her way alone. All you send into the life of another comes back into your own. And that made a whole lot of sense to me when I was offered this workshop. It's something to just share with y'all. I really believe that dreams do come true. And I know that that's why I'm here, because my dream came true. I'm all right in my skin today. And because I'm all right in my skin today, I don't have to take advantage of anybody. I let the people live that God has blessed to live. I did everything to kill myself. And as my sister said, y'all let me live. Why shouldn't I let y'all live? So if I've said anything to offend anybody, you know, it's my story. I'm sticking with it. And I want to thank y'all for letting me share. My name is Walson. I'm going to keep coming back.
I'd like to thank both of our speakers this afternoon. We still have some time. If there's anybody that would like to come up and share, we still have some time before we close out this workshop. Please remember there's other people that might like to share too. You could come up to the podium. Anybody want to share?